Okay, so I actually wanted to, I had a big goal that was given to me by David, and we were all assigned topics by David, and I see that no one kept to the topic that David gave them, including David, so I didn't either. His theme. What I want to do today is give a kind of overview of where theory is at in neuroscience, and a little bit pick up topics that have been, you know, thrown around the dinner tables in the last couple of days of kind of what is theory, what is modeling, what does an experimentalist want a theorist to do, what can experimentalists contribute to us, and what can we contribute back. And to do that, I want to kind of zoom in on a particular thread through this slew of work of the last many years, which is sort of to look at what we know about networks, and then to go to the level that that we've seen from Clay and Steve in the last few days. So the network as conceptualized by an experimentalist, which is really a set of neurons. I wish I had a better picture, you know, taking one from either of you today. This would have shown all the neurons, their different types, lighting up in different colors, their connections mapped out in full detail. Eventually, I mean, that's where we're going, right? That's what the experimentalists promised to provide us with within the next 10 years. And so as theorists, what are we going to do with that data? Okay, so that was the experimentalist neural network. Here's the theorist neural network. So what it is, thanks to this picture of Larry Abbott's and another picture of Heinz and Polinsky, actually the style of those two theorists is very nicely pictured by these two pictures. So a neural network by a theorist is a set of neurons or simple firing units that are basically identical. We heard from John yesterday some of the beautiful properties that even this very simple picture can give us. You know, John talked about attractor systems, and as we know from his work and by work over the decades since then, that attractors in neural networks are a phenomenon that does emerge from this structure, and that can explain a lot of data in a very maybe high-level conceptual way. That's a way of storing memories. It's a way, as John told us yesterday, if we have some leakiness of moving through a space semi-autonomously. A network like that can also generate chaos. In fact, it generically will generate chaos. And Chaim Sompolinsky and Karl Franz Wieserich showed that if one has such a network hooked up with certain assumptions about the connectivity, what you'll get is a state of balanced excitation inhibition, and this already came up today. This is something that's been seen experimentally. The neural network gives us a conceptual level picture of why we would expect to see that. So here's what you're seeing coming into any one of those neurons. There's a large amount of inhibition, a large amount of excitation, but due to a sort of self-emergent balance in the size of those two terms, they more or less cancel out. So what you're left with is a fluctuating term that gives you stochasticity at the single neuron level. Okay, so more recently, some beautiful work initially by Maas and Jaeger have put up the idea of how we might be able to use such a system to actually compute. So with the idea of the liquid state machine is that if we connect up a bunch of neurons like that, we allow them to generate complex dynamics, we can use that dynamics as essentially a pool of basis functions, more or less random basis functions, from which we can kind of extract any feature we like. And so if we pull out the outputs of that bunch of neurons evolving under that complicated dynamics, we can train an output neuron to report almost any function we like. More recently, Larry Abbott has developed that idea to show that one can learn quickly to output very complicated patterns, and even to do some simple kind of predictions. So here's what individual neurons are doing. They're behaving in a very complicated, chaotic-looking way. If you train the weights on that output neuron appropriately, you can force that network to read out for you a very well-defined function, even though individual neurons are doing this. And so if we're thinking experimentally, if we threw an electrode into our system and it was behaving like this, we would see these complicated dynamics and be somewhat at a loss to know what the system was actually doing and how that behavior came about. Another aspect of neural network behavior that's become accessible, David was supposed to talk about high-throughput electrophysiology, sort of got the impression from Clay's talk that there was a good reason for not talking about that because it's kind of obsolete. The need to do is imaging. And that, nonetheless, we do have these beautiful tools where one can record from hundreds or even thousands of neurons simultaneously, extracellularly. Groups like E.J. Chytunsky and Michael Berry have used these tools to record from every neuron in a patch of retina. Now that gives us, as theorists, the opportunity to now make predictions or claims about what such a population code should do. And hopefully, sometime during this next couple of weeks, you'll hear more from Alad about how we might quantify the effect of correlations in the behavior of those neurons. Theoretical models have shown that, have addressed this question, you know, so how are correlations propagated through a neural network? This is some work from Jaime de la Rocha and collaborators, where they address the question of, given a neural network, if you have inputs that have some certain amount of correlation, which you can think about as the signal, how well does that correlation propagate from layer to layer of a network? So let's, you know, simplify the question down. We have two neurons that are being driven by some signal. Some of that signal is common between those two inputs. If we look at their output spike trains, how much correlation is there in the output spike train? And they showed that we have a network of integrated firing neurons, there's actually a very clear relationship between the output correlation and nothing to do with the characteristics of the network, but instead that just scales directly with the output with the firing rate of your input. So if you arrange your noise inputs to have a certain mean, a standard deviation that drive those inputs with a certain firing rate, then you'll have a certain amount of correlation in the output. Now, I just put that up as an example of the sort of things that people are calculating. Really, the point I wanted to make with that is that it turns out that if you replace those neurons that are in this model with integrated firing neurons with a more realistic conductance-based neural model, then this whole property disappears. And that's been shown recently by Sung-ho Hong and Andrea Barea working with Eric Shea Brown, which says we have to take biophysics seriously. Neurons are not exponential integrated firing neurons. So, well, at least they can be, but they're not always. So really where I want to go with this is that given that we have detailed knowledge of biophysics, there's a huge amount of neuronal diversity, what should that be doing for theory, and how does that kind of bust our basic theories? And to what extent, where should we situate ourselves between taking into account very realistic neuronal dynamics, synaptic dynamics, and all the other properties of neural systems, and thinking about these more high-level models? So just a final example of someone who's kind of working at that interface, Nancy Capel's work, has shown that, well, so Nancy kind of takes realistic neural models and works with them, and they've shown that one can generate gamma oscillations by connecting together pyramidal interneurons with excitatory pyramidal cells. You get a very nicely reproduced aspects of the gamma oscillation. And they've taken that type of modeling further by considering how the gamma rhythm interacts with beta rhythms to give you this beta 2 rhythm, where this model includes, you know, effects of interneuron busters, the M current, the H current, that all help to give you the time scales of those oscillations. This is modeling, well, what are called modeling, rather than theory. So I wanted to say, just make a point about, so there's, I think, a real distinction between thinking about things in terms of dynamics, where we really want to reproduce the detailed characteristics of the system, versus function. And this really came up today already. So what is the functional role of an element in the circuit? And I think when we're talking about function, that really takes us into the domain of theory, whereas modeling tries to take into account all the detailed data that we know and try and predict an outcome given that data. And I'll come back to that general distinction. Neuronal diversity. I come from a department, Chuck's department, you know, and many illustrious scientists around me and who have passed through before have been really obsessed with this idea that neurons in different parts of the brain are built the way they are in order to carry out a specific function that is related to that piece of the brain that they're located in. We have this whole diverse array of ion channels. Surely that diversity has a reason. So here's a couple of examples. Bill Spain's work in the avian auditory brainstem, Bill Spain and others, So these neurons in nucleus magnocellularis have very short time scales. They need that because this part of the brain is responsible for transmitting sound pulses. If you want to be able to localize sound, you need to be sensitive to timing differences that are microseconds. And so these neurons have extremely fast time scales. They perform DC filtering, that is, they only respond to the onset of a step. And this is brought about due to the action of low-threshold potassium channels. So one example. Another example that's actually a lot less clear is thalamic relay neurons. So we don't really know why they behave the way they do, but they have a very characteristic biophysics. They have T-type calcium channels, which give them a slow dynamics, and so they tend to burst. And so it's been a question for many people for a while, so what is the role of those bursts? What special coding properties do bursts have compared to single spikes or tonic spikes?
But those are bursts when they're sort of in the sleep state, not in the sort of relay state, and there's no experimental evidence for these bursts occurring when the animals are actually awake.
Well, this is just a neuron in a slice being driven by noise, and this is not in a upstate or a downstate, it's just a, you know, it's got a depolarization of minus 70, it's in a normal awake state, and these are certainly bursty. This is data from Sackman's lab. Data were taken by my student while Sackman was somewhere else, probably. Okay, so so the question I want to pose here is, how can neuronal differences contribute to computation? How seriously should we take them when we're building network models? So here's a kind of overview of where people are at theoretically with dealing with single neurons and single neuron models. There are really two approaches to modeling single neurons. One is sort of a dynamical picture. At the limit, what we can do is build conductance-based models that take into account morphology, all the appropriate ion channel dynamics. As theorists, most of us don't want to work with models of that complexity, and so there are a lot of really beautiful and elegant simplifications of those along the lines of Chuck's work from many years ago. So the integrating fire neuron we've already mentioned, the very most simple neuron model that you could imagine. You can make a better neuron model that captures a lot more experimental data by considering the sub-threshold behavior to be either quadratic or exponential. Izakevich's simple model now takes it from being just a one-dimensional model to a two-dimensional model. That gives the model a lot more power. And there are other low-dimensional analytical reductions that go along the lines of the Conner-Stevens model that take the Hodgkin-Huxley dynamics and analytically reduce that to fewer parameters. On the other hand, you have functional models that try to capture what exactly a neuron computes or what it represents in its output spike drain. So at the simplest level, a neuron can be described in terms of its tuning curve or receptive field. What is it about the input that drives a firing rate, and at what firing rate given some property of the input? It's been elaborated somewhat by Gerstner's lab to the spike response model that also takes into account how long it's been since the most recent spike. So that allows us to incorporate the effects of, say, after hyperpolarizations that are part of the intrinsic dynamics of the cell. And more recently, models like the generalized linear model that essentially is the same as this, but maybe a little more systematic.
I got it wrong, but in the beginning, when you talked about the correlations, you said that the integrating fire model reproduces these exponential observations in slices with the two neurons quite okay, but when you go to a conductance-based model,
it breaks down.
It doesn't. So I would say the integrating fire model is more realistic.
Well, it depends on the neuron type, right?
I mean, and it might be that so when
QRF, I think that's VRF, such a stretch. There's one piece of data in which one behavior looks like another behavior.
Yeah. Treat more realistically is the current about which we know least, the sodium current.
We'll continue this discussion for 8 weeks or so. Right. So, just to give an example of the types of things people are doing, reduced dynamical models. This is one of the ones I mentioned on the previous slide, Izakevich's simple model. It's actually a very elegant, lovely model, I think, which is that it takes the nonlinear term to be simply a quadratic, but adds in a second equation that controls the inactivation variable. And so, in terms of the way I think about neuron firing, that having these 2 degrees of freedom in your dynamics gives you a lot of power. And so such a model, as one twiddles the parameters of this model, is able to reproduce a lot of different firing characteristics of neurons that we observe in real life.
So Adrian, the usual 15 Aguma model has sort of V cubed.
Yeah.
And do you know why somehow?
Well, so the difference between the reason that V cubed is good if you don't want to add something that brings you back to reset. So what's maybe a downside of this model is that you have to specifically add an upper voltage at which you then return yourself back to resting. So Fitzsimmons-Gumow model will automatically bring itself back to resting.
Oh, that's that line. That's the reset.
And so obviously a cubic is the lowest order nonlinearity that would let you return without having to add in a reset by hand. However, this gives you a lot of power actually, because you can get things like adaptation and other effects because of the reset. Okay, functional models, what do I mean by that? So really what we're trying to address here is what does a neuron compute, in the sense that if you see a spike, what does that tell you about the input? And here's kind of the very most basic idea of that you have some input coming into your system. The system is extracting some feature or some set of features out of that input. There's some nonlinearity whereby, depending on how similar your stimulus is to those two features, for example, then you have some lookup table that tells you your probability of firing given similarity. And one can add spike history times that take you closer to something like the GLM or the spike response model. So let's just look at an example, the integrating firing neuron. So what is the integrating firing neuron? It's simply linear. It linearly integrates the stimulus below threshold with some leak term. And so you're linearly accumulating, but you're decaying in time. What that would look like in terms of this kind of feature threshold function model is that you have some kernel, which is just exponentially decaying in time, and you're passing it through a decision function, which is 0 up to some threshold and 1 above that threshold. Now, if we're trying to think about how to generalize that to any neuron, then what we need to do is amend this subthreshold behavior to some appropriate linearized system, which is now going to replace that linear feature that corresponds to this exponential behavior with some other linear feature, and a decision function with the one that just arises directly from the nonlinearity of the model. And so if one goes about and just fits a model like that for, say, the Hodgkin-Huxley neuron, what one finds is that it's nothing like an integrating firing neuron. In fact, it has an effective linear kernel that's more like a resonator or an oscillator. And the nonlinearity is not like a threshold in one dimension. It actually lives in two dimensions, and it has this peculiar curve shape. So it's very different than an exponential and firing neuron.
What are the two dimensions?
What's that?
What are the two dimensions?
They are, so if one does the analysis allowing yourself to use the covariance of the input, then you can find two features that are most relevant to the firing of the cell. And so in terms of those two features, you have some firing rate that...
You mean temporal covariance function?
Temporal covariance, right. This is all, I mean, it's only a scalar input, right? Just the current coming in. So that tells you that biophysical properties intimately control the feature selectivity of an individual neuron. It also controls what I would call response gating, and these are things that Andrea has worked on in the past. So as I told you already, what a typical neuron in a network will see is something like this very complicated fluctuating input. Now, Larry Abbott and others pointed out that as you change the variance of that input, you can change the way the neuron processes information. So if one imagines what the input coming into a given neuron is going to look like as an animal goes about the world and interacts with its output, one can imagine that you keep this detailed balance, so you're very close to zero mean, but that the overall amplitude of that stimulus is going to vary in time. As the animal is doing something or gets aroused or some stimulus comes into its field of view, it's very likely that this is a typical kind of natural stimulus for a neuron embedded deep in a network. Now, if we consider how the neuron is going to encode information under these different conditions, it's likely to be very different. So here, let's think for a bit that the goal of the system is to encode, say, the mean. There's going to be some slowly varying mean. When we think about it, it's being given to us in a background of this noisy stimulus. So we're not thinking about trying to encode the noise at the moment. We're trying to think about encoding a mean, given that there is this background noise. And the amplitude of that background noise, it's been shown, has a strong effect on the encoding of the stimulus. So if we have some FI curve that we measure in the background of zero noise, say by just injecting a constant current into our neuron and counting the firing rate, if we now sample that at some different background noise level, one finds that the slope of that curve can vary as a function of background noise. Right? And so what one has is sort of a context-dependent encoding of mean current by firing rate, where the context is given by the variance of that background noise. So this sort of comes back to a question that was posed a long time ago by Moshe Avila. So is the cortical neuron an integrator or a coincidence detector? Now, in this language, if it were an integrator, all it would care about is that mean current, because if it's integrating, that mean the background noise is fluctuating away and will average away, and so it shouldn't be sensitive to that at all. Whereas if it's a coincidence detector, it's going to be sensitive to large fluctuations that are rapid in time. It's going to be looking for cases where there was a large synchronous event in the network that led to kind of a spike in the input. And so sensitivity to the mean versus the variance is some kind of discrimination.
Reading that abstract kind of makes me worry that I might be missing an abstraction here. When you're talking about inputs and outputs or inputs in the decision, I was understanding that to mean like a single input. But here, you know, right in the second sentence, there's language about several presynaptic spikes.
Okay, so remember that what I've been showing you is the net here. When we talked about what inputs into a network, I mean, this is theory, but if you actually record, you know, as people like Alan Destex have done, to record what the inputs look like coming into a neuron in a network in vivo, then you see something like this, right? You see something that's noisy and fluctuating. Now, this is coming about because you're having impinged upon you spiking from the entire network. And what's going to lead to large fluctuations that are positive or negative is when you have many synchronous inputs coming in from excitatory or inhibitory neurons.
So we should be including that in our thinking, that these are synchronous.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, in terms of the theory, it's easy to just say, okay, that's what the network is giving me. What I care about at the level of myself as a single neuron is sort of what the statistical properties of that input look like. What's the mean? What's the standard deviation? I'm interested maybe in what the timing of particular fluctuations in that input, but I don't need to know which neuron they came from. And in fact, I can't know what neuron they came from.
Yes, but you can know whether you fire a spike. I mean, you decide whether or not.
You decide based on this whether or not you're going to fire a spike. That's right.
Okay, I'm just trying to reconcile this with my own private theory about what neurons are doing.
Okay.
It has more to do with listening to different people out there yelling at me, and they all yell at once and wake up.
Okay.
So that's really the sum of all the inputs.
This is the sum of all the inputs, right? And at the level of the single neuron, you have no way of knowing where and how in the network they were generated. All you care about as a neuron is sort of what is it about that fluctuating input that actually triggers you to fire. And there are two ways. I really want to make a distinction between a couple of different ways of looking at that. Maybe I'm only interested in this sort of slowly oscillating input. Maybe the signals in the world that are interesting to me are going to be encoded by some slowly varying mean. Or I might be interested in the timing of very large spikes in that input that tell me something very significant about the world. And as I just showed you, the biophysics of the neuron is going to tell me a lot about what in that input is going to trigger myself, particular neuron, to fire, whether I'm more integrator-like and I'm just going to smooth that out, or whether I'm like a Hodgkin-Huxley neuron, sensitive to very rapid fluctuations that are going to cause me to fire. John?
How you view the whole thing as coming out depends a lot on whether that weakly signal is actually independent of every neuron, or whether there are correlations between neurons of that weakly signal, in which case the whole game is different.
Well, the game of deciding what a given neuron does is not different, because
the game of attributing that to meaning to that is different.
Right. But yeah, I'm not going to play the game of meaning. I'm just a single neuron. So if I'm sensitive to fluctuations that sort of implies that I'm looking for correlations, right? Because those are only going to happen when some bunch of neurons out there are all firing simultaneously. So whether or not I'm interested in that depends a lot on the time scale of the responses in the network that are telling me about the signal. So I think we can't know, looking at this, what the signal is and what's important for the neuron. I think what we can do mathematically is say, well, how do I encode the mean, the variance, fluctuations in the input, and how does that depend on the biophysics of the neuron, and how is it different? How is that different for different neurons in my network depending on their biophysics? Which is all I want to do. I'm sort of agnostic about what it is that is the true signal. Okay, so where do we want to go? Oh yeah, forward. So just to go back to this idea of something being an integrator or a differentiator based on its sensitivity to noise, to variance versus mean, if I'm differentiator-like, that should mean that I don't really care about the mean input, that I'm only driven by fluctuation, so on the average. So if we had a neuron that had a filter, as I showed you for the Hodgkin-Huxley neuron, remember that looks something like this, if you saw the little picture. So what a Hodgkin-Huxley neuron is sensitive to is sort of the difference between the stimulus at some time back and the stimulus at some time in that, the more recent past, and so it's going to differentiate, essentially perform a local differentiation on the input. So it's going to be driven more by the mean. If it's an integrator, it's going to average over those small fluctuations and be driven by the average only. Okay, so what do real neurons do? So here's a neuron somatosensory cortex. Its FI curve is independent of the background variance. So if we sample this curve for several different values of input variance, then we get no change at all. In somatosensory cortex, you see that this FI curve is in fact modulated by the background variance. Prefrontal cortex, same thing. In auditory brainstem, neurons of the type that I mentioned before, NM neurons, are actually not driven at all by a constant input, as I mentioned. They're DC filters, so they only fire to the onset of a step, and they don't fire at all unless there's some noise driving them. So we can really think about this, like to think about this as really three different types of neurons, ones that are completely insensitive to noise, ones that are modulated by noise, and ones that require noise to fire at all.
What's the difference between the first and the second panel?
Between this one and this one?
The sensory cortex.
Yes, I'm not sure exactly which type of neuron we're recorded from. Okay. Yeah, sorry.
The blue curve is just a change in the mean, and the others are also changing.
This is a change. Every time I'm changing the mean, I'm not changing the mean. Whoever did this experiment was changing the mean, and for three different values of the standard deviation of background noise.
The force is really the firing rates, right?
Yeah, it's firing fast.
Down there might be a dependence that we just don't see.
Well, it's kind of trivial dependence. If you have something that has a sharp threshold like a Hodgkin-Huxley neuron and you add a bit of noise, you can always push yourself above thresholds. This is a very uninteresting type of modulation by standard deviation.
Do the other neurons saturate at all, their firing rates?
This one definitely does. You sort of get depolarization block, right? So this one saturates, this one's hitting depolarization blocks, so is this one.
I'm just wondering if you run them until they saturate, then they'll probably all look like that.
All look like this? You think
they
way up
saturate.
Here? Maybe. You think what you're doing really is just blowing up this. Yeah. Let me show you some further. Right, so it turns out that if you look at standard model neurons, this behavior is not captured at all. So here's what an integrating firing neuron does. That's what a Hodgkin-Huxley neuron does. So this is the effect that I told you about already. It has, for zero noise, we has this well-known jump to a finite firing rate that you can smooth out by adding noise, but that's not very interesting and is not what we see in the real neurons. Conner-Stevens model doesn't reproduce it. Miles Traub model doesn't reproduce it either. So it does turn out that if you take the standard Hodgkin-Huxley model and change some of its parameters, you can get back this behavior. So here's the case where it's insensitive to noise. You change one single parameter, you can make it modulated by noise, and you can turn it into a regime where it's only driven by noise, which I think is Hodgkin type 3, in fact, this case.
What's the secret parameter?
It's just the sodium conductance. So working with a reduced model, I mean, bizarrely, but I'll explain why. So working with a reduced model, so we're going to take this Hodgkin-Huxley, boil it down to two dimensions so that we can look at it in the phase plane. Really the trick, so here what I'm showing you is, these are the, in terms of the voltage and this inactivation variable U, these are the lines where dUdt is zero, the line where dVdt is zero. Where they meet is the point where both of them are zero. This is a fixed point, which can either be stable or unstable. In this case, where they cross on that side of the minimum of the null line, this is an unstable fixed point. And so if we start our trajectory, say here, what that's going to do is zoom across according to the flow in this direction, reach that manifold, curl around and enter into, because this fixed point is unstable, we're going to just fire continuously. And so this is the tonic firing case. However, as we add some input current I, what that's going to do is shift that null cline. And you can see what happened there is that dot changed from red to blue, which means it went from being unstable to being stable. And now if we start a trajectory at this point, it's going to spiral up, follow around that null cline, and just settle down to zero at that fixed point. And so these two cases give us very different sensitivity to noise. So let's see what happens as we drive our input now around a fixed value of I with a noisy current. We're going to kind of loop around and around. And as you see, every time we come around, the noise is having a big effect on where exactly we go through that trajectory. And here, the case of the stable fixed point, you're basically hovering around that fixed point, and every now and then, the noise will kick you into a spike. So here, you're firing tonically, and the noise is going to kind of shift your firing rate a little bit. Whereas here, fundamentally different property, you're basically at zero, and you're driven by noise. And this is the case where you have the normal sodium parameters. This is the case where you drop the sodium to a lower value. Okay, so one can show that there's really a very well-defined boundary of purely noise-driven firing in a model neuron. So if we kind of play around in the space of the conductance parameters, one can show that there's a line of parameters at which you get firing at zero noise, and you get neurons that look like DC filters. Yeah, Andrea.
In experiments, can you switch neurons between acting one way and the other with low doses of TTX?
You can do it, but we can't do it. We don't know how to titrate TTX. Don't know how to do that controllably. At least Bill Spain, my experimental collaborator, wasn't willing to do. He felt like that wasn't a clean experiment. But it would be a great thing to do. But even nicer would be to use dynamic clamp of the speeds that you guys use and no one else to subtract out a little bit of the sodium conductance. Okay, so simple biophysical parameter moves you between these very different firing properties.
Does that have something to do by any chance with the M cubed infinity and the H infinity curve?
The explanation that we have for that is a little bit simpler, actually. It's to do, we believe, with a time scale that really is determined by sort of how fast you're going around this firing curve. And that's determined by the interplay of sodium potassium, which generates your intrinsic time scale. So for in this case, where your time scale, your relevant time scale is 5 milliseconds, you're kind of moving around. There's a little bit of inertia. So every time you fire with the same mean, but your period of a single cycle is sort of changed, as we saw before, a little bit by noise. In this case, when you're moving slowly, which is the case when you have the low sodium, it was also low sodium with a slow inactivation, which I should point out. So here, what's going on is that you're moving around that cycle slowly, so that now as you come toward the fixed point, all noise can do is kick you off earlier rather than later. You never get to a point where you go beyond that edge of that null cline. So noise can only shorten your cycle. Yeah?
So you just talked about the conductance. So I guess what that means is changing the number of channels, the concentration.
Yeah.
What if you, can you also just change the reversing potential by changing concentrations? That you can do on maybe a faster time scale?
I don't remember whether that was a manipulation that worked for this.
Is it possible that different...
Brian, the student who did this, tried a number of different manipulations, and this is the one that he got to work consistently. it's possible that that could have the same effect.
But it's possible that different parts of the brain have different concentrations?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, well, what we can see from this is just by changing that single parameter, you can move a neuron between these very different computational states.
I might not get it, but alternatively, just how far you are from threshold rest and whether.
Is that equivalent to this?
Yeah, I mean, just when you're far from threshold, noise is the thing that modulates your gain curve. And when you're above threshold, you're both firing at a given rate, and noise is less.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of equivalent to this.
Okay, so.
All right, so I'm just. So this slow time scale confers sensitivity to fluctuations, and this is the one experiment that we did do, which was directly, rather than manipulating the sodium conductance, to change the time scale of an AHP. So I didn't do this. This is work by Matt Higgs and Bill Spain, who pointed out that the effect that Chance and Abbott had shown can go in either direction. And so here they have a pyramidal neuron where they've added in a slow after hyperpolarization, which gives us this slow time scale, and you create this sensitivity to noise. If you don't have that AHP, which is the case with many pyramidal neurons, then you lose that sensitivity. Okay, so slow timescales, that's how biophysics can change the way that slow signals are encoded. What I talk about now is where these signals are in fact relevant to the system. So we're not thinking about just encoding something that's slowly varying in the background of something that changes fast, but instead where this signal is actually important and we want to keep all of it. So David gave an example like this where you had a rat's whiskers moving up and down, and he separated that signal into the phase, which is these fast fluctuations with the addition of some midpoint. I didn't talk about that, but that was sort of what we were doing already with the FI curve where you have some slow varying mean in the presence of changes in amplitude. And so there's a midpoint signal, amplitude signal, and a phase signal. So I'm going to concentrate really just on the amplitude signal and how that modifies the way that you encode fast fluctuations in the input. So just to drill that point home, if we have, say, some fluctuation of a given size which is occurring here, fluctuation of about the same size occurring here, they're happening in very different contexts and with very different stimulus histories. And so what one finds is that such signals can be encoded very differently because of that history. Okay, so what I've talked about so far is a type of gain control, right? What we've seen is that there's a change in the slope of the FI curve according to the variance of a background noise. So really that what that's doing is modulating the slope of the response. So we're changing the size of the output with respect to a given input. There's another type of gain control that I'll talk about from now on, which is really changing the way we represent the input. So it's changing the scale of the input relative to an overall scale. So let's see if I can explain that better. So we're going to think about the stimulus as being this fluctuation, so in David's case, the phase, multiplied by some envelope. So the stimulus is the product of some time-varying envelope with some rapid fluctuation. We can decompose a signal like that. And now the firing rate I'd like to propose is we can model as being a multiplier, which is the overall firing rate, which is a function of that envelope, multiplied by some threshold function acting on the rapid stimulus, now normalized by the envelope. And so the point of that would be, in order to encode stimuli in units that are kind of normalized by their natural scale. So in the case of the rat whisking, the rat is able to whisk a small whisk and whisk a large whisk. You'd really like to know the phase within the oscillation of that whisk, or you might like to know the phase within the oscillation of that whisk, and encode it sort of equally well, independent whether that's a large whisk or a small whisk. And so one would like to encode the stimulus in normalized units. However, this prefactor carries information about the overall scale in ways that we saw already were subject to gain control. Okay, so why do you want to do this? One of the very few, I think, kind of globally applicable ideas in neuroscience is the optimal coding hypothesis. To what extent this really holds in detail, I think, is definitely up for grabs, but at least it's an idea that gives us something to look for in many different neural systems. With the idea that sensory systems are trying to maximize the amount of information that they carry, and so they should want to make maximally efficient use of their available bandwidth. And so what that says is if you have an input that's distributed with some particular distribution, one should want to match one's dynamic range to the scale of that input. So as we saw with natural stimuli, they tend to change their overall scale regularly or periodically or constantly, let's say, in time. So what the system should want to track that overall scale and match its input-output to that scale. Okay, so we've shown a long time ago that this happens in the fly visual system. So if you take a motion signal that's varying with some time-varying amplitude, and you now look at the way single spikes encode that motion, if you take spikes from different pieces of that signal that have different overall amplitudes, what you find is that there's an input-output relation that describes the firing rate with respect to the stimulus by this whole family of curves, a different curve for every point in this presentation. And what one can do is then normalize those curves by the overall scale, and one finds that there's in fact one single curve, but a curve whose range is being modulated dynamically by the range of the stimulus. Yeah.
How many neurons away is this neuron from?
It's about 4 synapses in from the photoreceptors.
And how far in do you think this principle should hold? At a certain point, you're doing computation.
Yeah,
that's right. Throwing away information.
Right. No, absolutely. So let me show you another figure. So here's another example of that. And so here's with neurons in rat barrel cortex. So here it's an anesthetized animal. The whiskers are being moved up and down. And this work done by Miguel Maravai in Matthew Diamond's lab. And so here, simpler experiment, the amplitude of the input is just being modulated between two different values. Same analysis, we take spikes from those different regimes of the presentation. So we take them from the low amplitude and the high amplitude parts of the cycle, get two different curves. If you normalize them, they come out to be the same thing. And there's data from other examples of data that certainly have the same flavor. So here's data from Dario Ringach measuring from V1. What he finds is that neurons sensitive to orientation seem to have approximately the same input-output curve when stimuli are measured in normalized units, normalized by their contrast. And so this flavor sort of seems to show up throughout sensory processing. What I want to show you now is that this turns out to be prevalent, or at least to be implementable, at very low levels. Right? And so here, what we did was to record from single cortical neurons, where we're injecting current directly into a single cortical neuron. So as one changes the amplitude of the noisy signal that's being put into that neuron, we measure the firing rates. One finds that there's a whole family of input-output curves, as we saw for the systems cases, where the slope of these curves, if we normalize by standard deviation, again turn out to be it's the same curve, but it's just modulated by the standard deviation of the input. And so while in all the cases I showed you before, this is a situation that's happening, you know, many synapses in, there seem to be lots of opportunities for that computation to be taking place and be potentially circuit mediated. Here we see that behavior can be implemented at the level of single neurons and certainly not require any changes in parameter or any slow circuit level, say, synaptic plasticity. Okay, so just to quantify how well this works, the way that we've chosen to see how close those two curves are. So what I've shown you over and over again is just dividing out the standard deviation and showing you that they overlay. And we'd like to do a bit better than that to quantify that property. So what we're going to do is look at the distance, Kullback-Leibler distance, between the distributions of spike-triggered responses. So we have, if we look at all the spikes that are triggered under, say, stimulus with variance 1, and we look back at the stimulus and we say, well, what were the values of the stimulus that triggered a spike? And do the same thing under the case where it's being driven with a stimulus of variance 2. what we'd like to see is if we normalize that stimulus by the variance, those two distributions would become the same distribution, right? And so if we now just measure the similarity of these two distributions using the Kolbach-Leibler distance, that will give us a measure of how close our input-output curves are, because the distribution of inputs is the same in both cases. It's just a Gaussian in all the cases I've shown you so far. Now, what I'd like to show you is that this normalized representation actually emerges in single cortical neurons during development. So if one records from many different neurons at a relatively mature stage, one finds this whole family of curves. If one normalizes the stimulus that was used to drive them by the standard deviation that was used in each experiment, one finds that that whole population of curves, as we saw for Dario's data, has a kind of universal form. So we weren't expecting this. In fact, the way that we did these experiments, we weren't looking for this property. We were just driving the neurons with a standard deviation that we took that gave an approximately constant firing rate for all the different neurons in the sample. That was very different for individual neurons depending on their input resistance and various other properties. When we went back and normalized out that standard deviation, they all came out to be the same. If we look at the same property earlier on at P0, then we see much more spread in those input-output curves, P0. So mature, I'm calling P7. Not very mature, kind of immature, but less immature than P0. So if one then just compares the value of how different those input-output curves were for the immature neurons compared to the mature neurons, you can see that there's a big difference. So what I showed you in the previous data was what we got from every neuron sampled with just one distribution, and then we compared across the population. Really now what we need to do is see that every individual neuron is also able to scale out that standard deviation. And so these neurons were all driven with two standard deviations, with a standard deviation of 1 and 1.3, and we looked at the similarity of their input-output curves, and we saw that the mature neurons have much more similar input-output curves than the ones at P0. Okay, so what needs to be true for this to happen? We have really a very reduced system. We have a single neuron with a relatively small complement of ion channels at this stage. And in fact, what Rebecca found was that if we went in and figured out what were the channel values, or how much current was coming into these neurons, and plotted the values of sodium versus potassium current, one sees that as time goes by, as one gets closer to P10, these are initially scattered at around P0, so they're falling all over the plane. But as one gets closer to what we're calling mature, these values sort of move toward falling on a line. So it seems to be there's some kind of restriction in the values of these parameters, at least in this two-dimensional space. If we translate that into a model, so now what we're going to do is take a very simple Hodgkin-Huxley model with timescales that are adapted for mammalian systems. And now we take our models and we stimulate them with a range of different variances in the input, and now vary the conductance parameters of our model. And so here's a case where the potassium to sodium ratio is low. We calculate the input-output curves for all of these different inputs, and we overlay them, normalized. What we'd like to see, what we saw in the data, is that they all collapse onto one curve. If that ratio is small, then this collapse doesn't happen, right? So only as one pushes up the potassium to sodium ratio do we get that collapse.
What is that, Sissa?
What is this?
Yeah.
Stimulus over standard deviation. Now, what is stimulus?
Standard deviation of the noise. Stimulus.
Of the noise. Stimulus. It's not exactly the point-wise value of the noise. So what I showed you before was the way that we characterize neural computation is we think about the system as being driven by the similarity to some feature. And we identify that feature as the spike-triggered average. So you take every spike, you look back in time, you see what's the average feature that leads to that spike. That's kind of an estimate of what it is, what feature it is about the stimulus that's interesting for this cell. And so in this case, S is not the current. It's the current over some previous time weighted by that feature. And then we normalize that by the standard deviation. So it's kind of the interesting aspect of the current, whatever it is, for that cell.
What kind of cell is this model neuron?
These are model neurons.
Okay.
So,
what model?
What model? It's the Menon-Sinofsky, Hodgkin-Huxley-like You have a complaint?
No, I don't have a complaint. You changed the prefactor on two active currents, the ratio of the prefactors.
Yeah, that's it. So the time scales are all the same. All we did was change the prefactor.
So that's multi-compartmental?
No, it's a one, okay, maybe so two, one or two compartmental one.
Kinetics.
Yeah, right. Left the kinetics the same. We just changed the sodium to potassium ratio. And so,
what's the special thing in the cells? What else beyond Hodgkin-Huxley is there that's giving it a special scale property?
Nothing. I know you don't believe that, but it's true. Nothing. It's the simplest neuron you can imagine. Just has sodium and potassium and a leak.
So you're saying the Hodgkin-Huxley cell that we all grew up with, right? So we brutalized.
Well, the mammalian one. So if you look at the spike-triggered average of this Hodgkin-Huxley in these parameters, you don't get something like that. You get something more like an integrator kernel. So they're different, but.
But there's only sodium and potassium currents.
Only sodium and potassium currents.
And it gives you this scale, this rescaling. Yeah.
So it's kind of remarkable, in fact, that this property that we saw at the systems level that seems to do something very intelligent and appropriate for the system is implementable at this very low level in single neuron dynamics.
And nothing funky happens? I mean, the nature of the bifurcation, it's still a half bifurcation. In this familiar
line. No, in this case, it's a saddle knot with these saddle for these line. Kinetics and parameters.
That could be valid. Okay, so just to sort of show the full space of possible parameters, as we scan around in parameter space over the whole kind of range of sodium versus potassium, and we calculate the difference in the input-output curves for different values, for different changes in the standard deviation. These are very large changes in standard deviation, so they're going to give us the largest differences. But as we push up this potassium to sodium ratio, then the differences in those input-output curves get smaller and smaller. Right. So even when the neuron is not a very good gain scaler, if you don't have a very large change in standard deviation, your input-output curves are going to be very similar. But as those standard deviations get more and more different, then you see the differences in the input-output curves more. But now as you push up that ratio, all of the models have the property that they collapse onto a single input-output curve. Okay, just to summarize, so what we see is that single neurons exhibit this stimulus normalization and thus individually can act as efficient encoders. This property seems to emerge in cortical neurons over development. And modeling shows that simply the nonlinearity of sodium-potassium channels is enough to generate that behavior. Okay, so is this generic? I'm going to just zoom through this. So I showed you before that thalamic neurons are very different. They have these T-type calcium channels that give them sort of slow timescales in their behavior. If one goes and looks for the same effects in thalamic neurons, one would hope, since they're so different, that you don't get this property out. And in fact, that's what happens if you calculate the input-output curves for two different values of the standard deviation. The curves don't end up overlaying.
This was an experiment?
This is an experiment. This is all data.
You're done.
Pardon?
In which lab?
Oh, this was done in the Sekman and Kuhner labs by Rebecca Mies with help from the very dark Alexander Groh, who's a postdoc with Sekman.
Actually, there's still something that's bothering me. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, backing up to, you know, properties that unfold from Hodgkin and Huxley-like models. Okay. So a long, long time ago, I messed around with these things. And the really salient, striking thing to me about them, I mean, Hodgkin and Huxley, you know, what that means to me is you have these sort of empirically derived curves of coefficients, a few coefficients that depend on voltage.
Right.
And since there's no real biophysical model of the gating process or a relationship between activation and inactivation, those curves fall on the voltage axis wherever you measure them.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there are certain parts of those curves that are very hard to measure accurately,
right,
from the experimentalist point of view. But then when you do the simulation, you know, behaviors like the ones you're talking about depend with hair-raising, you know, strength on
details of those curves.
Details. You just shift one of those curves by 1 millivolt relative to the other one. You get a completely different kind of behavior. So, I mean, how does that parameter sensitivity propagate through these latter-day investigations?
Well, so that's really what we were trying to get at here, is we saw this behavior in this whole bunch of cortical neurons relatively early in development who actually have quite widely varying properties. You know, as I plotted on that line, they vary over this wide range of sodium potassium conductances. We didn't mess around with other parameters, but what we found was that just throwing in relatively, you know, standard Hodgkin-Huxley dynamics was enough to reproduce this behavior. So in some ways, this is a very robust property. And, you know, it's worth going back and seeing if one changes the kinetics or other details of the, certainly if you there are other models, Hodgkin-Huxley style mammalian models that don't do this, and it's exactly because of details of how the sodium potassium inactivation activation curves are arranged. They don't do it, but this model gets it. And
my feeling was that, you know, most of those parameters, you know, the model was pretty robust. You made a small change and you got a small effect. Okay. But the exception to that was the relative placement of the curves for M infinity and H infinity.
Right.
And those were just hair-raisingly squirrely.
Yeah, that's
kind of
true.
Impossible to measure.
Right. We haven't tried, you know, changing those in very small amounts. What we've tried is using a different version of a standard mammalian model and not reproducing this behavior. And the reason was exactly that it has really quite different, you know, spacing of the inactivation curves. So I think your intuition is right, completely. Yeah.
But isn't it part of it that so V one half is a very powerful parameter? Whatever kinetic thing, because think of the sodium.
Steepest.
Well, and also it's actually not so much E one half as that as the foot of the curve, you know, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So there are exponential. So you shift a little bit and you have
the
feet increase in
foot of the curve is
open problems.
Right. I guess our approach was, since it worked, we didn't go looking for ways to break it. You know, it really, the point is that you can get it from very simple dynamics, simple, reasonably well-established dynamics. Okay, thalamic neurons don't work. So we've seen already that they fire with this bursty property. One can really think about that, and, you know, Pam Reinagle and others have really thought about, so there being really two modes of information transmission, that you have very well separated spikes and then you have the burst spikes, and maybe they say different things about the input. If you look at the spike triggered average, those two timescales of the dynamics are reflected. You get a very fast kind of sodium-like, you know, Hodgkin-Huxley-like feature. Then you get this slow thing, which is what is causing the driving the calcium channels to be in the appropriate state. So yeah, zooming in on that fast thing, you see the sodium-like spike-triggered average. If one then separates out fast and slow events, so really you can think about, one could try thinking about this as being kind of events that are due to those slow dynamics and then events that are due to the fast dynamics. And now let's take spikes that are preceded by a long interval and spikes that are preceded by a short interval and do the analysis separately. So fast events, we now think about their relevant features being just that fast part at the end of the spike triggered average, the slow events being triggered by that slow calcium dynamics. And so now one finds that if you calculate the input-output curves for those two cases, then you get very nice scaling for the sodium-like events and poor scaling for the calcium events. So in some sense, this backs up what we saw with the cortical neurons, that it's these kind of Hodgkin-Huxley-like fast events that nicely show this scaling behavior, whereas you're kind of screwed up by at least the global behavior of the system is so screwed up by these slow events. They don't show the same kind of rescaling that the fast events do.
It seems odd because the slow changes in potential will change the rate at which you deinactivate. It seems like it's hard to separate.
It is true that one might not have expected it to work because of that, because you're really sitting at very different sort of means, right? And we're always measuring around as though the mean were zero, and it's not. You're kind of driven to different internal states by the slow dynamics. So I'm not sure why it works. We haven't really analyzed this closely enough to see why that happens, but it does work. All right, so what does that tell us about thalamic coding? We see we get coding of fast-bearing information, which shows this gain scaling. Could argue that that's consistent with this sodium-potassium dynamics. And what we need to figure out is exactly, as David points out, what's this sort of interaction of information at the fast and the slow timescales. Okay, so I just wanted to finish by sort of pointing toward where we're going. It's really thinking about how such gain scaling impacts information transmission through a network. And this is motivated by some observations in developing cortical networks that show that there are these large-scale spontaneous cortical waves during development. So you get these waves that kind of propagate nicely through cortex that happen over about the same time period. They're active at P0 and sort of are gone by P7. What we wanted to ask is whether these changes in the intrinsic properties that lead to the emergence of gain control could have any implication for stopping cortical waves. And so just the very simple simulation that Juliana here tried, which is to sort of try and figure out, you know, try and make a guess at what input into a given neuron should look like when it's embedded in one of these waves. So what you might see is that there's some kind of ramp of input, and that's in the background of sort of fluctuations that of noise in the network. So if you are a normal neuron, so a non-gain scaling neuron, you're going to be kind of driven by crossing threshold, right? So you're just going to wait till this event is large enough to cross threshold, and you're going to get a set of spikes that are relatively going to happen at relatively the same time, independent of that noise. Whereas if you are doing gain control, then you are become much more sensitive to that noise, because at all times you are scaling your threshold effectively to be sensitive to the range of this noise. And so what happens with gain scaling is that these firing of our neurons, which are being driven by the same ramp but with many different noise realizations, become much less synchronized. And so firing will be distributed throughout, which is going to break down any wave that's trying to propagate through the system. So here you would have a bunch of neurons that are just going to fire when the wave passes through, and they're thus going to keep propagating that wave, whereas here the firing of all the neurons which are seeing this wave is now distributed all over the place because they're now sensitive to the details of the noise, and the wave will dissipate. So it becomes much more difficult to propagate a wave of activity when every neuron is sensitive to kind of the details of the noise that are coming into it.
At P0, are you sure that you need spikes to propagate the wave?
No, I'm not actually. No, that's a good question. There are many other things that contribute to propagation of waves in the
context,
for sure.
P0, you have almost no circuits at all. Yeah. And the inhibitory neurons, about a half of them, have not migrated into the cortical plate yet. And by P7, you have to wait till P7 to even get the inhibitory neurons to move to the right locations.
Yeah. No, I realize there are many, many things going on in the circuit. There are changes in synaptic dynamics also that are happening. There are changes in timescales. There's change in input resistance. It's just really a question of, so given the ability of single neurons to either do gain control or not, what can we say about how information will propagate in them? All right. So just to conclude, not really about the content of the talk, but more about sort of the philosophy of what we're trying to do here. Theory in neuroscience. Really, I think we've had some lovely examples from Chuck and from John of sort of what we think about as theory in neuroscience. And I think I like to think about that as sort of the development of novel conceptual models that can explain or bring together disparate observations and make new predictions or suggest new experimental analyses. They can, as we saw today from Chuck, they can identify some minimal structure or minimal dynamics that explain a phenomenon. And finally, to try and identify computational and design principles. What I think experimentalists want from us is modeling. They want us to use known data to construct models that test the role of given mechanisms. And I really think these are distinct goals and both valuable, but when one talks with, say, Anirvan at dinner and he says, give me your best V1 model that will tell me if I knock out the somatostatin interneurons, what's it going to do to selectivity for orientation? That's a different goal than trying to develop a theory of the brain. And I think that both of these things have to be given space. I think that what has been done in theory and neuroscience has really pushed us to try doing different kinds of experiments. We may never be able to map the details of a high-level conceptual model onto detailed biophysics, but that doesn't mean it's not useful to do. And I think where our challenge is with new technologies and neuroscience is kind of bringing these things together. How do we go from these conceptual models to a model that allows us to incorporate data and see what is going to break, what holds up, what at the conceptual level maps on to details at the biological level. Finally, I put this down here, data analysis. Data analysis is what a lot of people do think of as kind of doing theory in neuroscience. It sort of sits independent of either of these two things. I think development of good tools to extract information and understanding from data feeds into modeling and it feeds into theory, and it sort of stands as a kind of separate endeavor that I think sort of has its own job to do. Right, that's all I wanted to say. So thanks a lot. Any
I just want to harp back to this adaptation business, because it seems like it's, you know, it should be on sort of page 2, right, of the neuroscience textbooks, because he's saying a Hodgkin-Huxley cell gives you a pulse, and a Hodgkin-Huxley cell in an axon gives you propagate, and you're also saying, oh, there's a third thing, that it actually gives you this rescaling. So do you have some flavor for, I mean, somehow we're incapable of dealing with 4 dimensions, so you always splatter it down to 2. Is there a low-dimensional model that you think?
Yeah, you can get this out of exponential integrative fire model. So it comes down to 1.
What's
Mike will give a seminar on that sometime during the next 2 weeks. So what we've been doing is, you know, given that this behavior comes out of such a simple system, it really gives us the chance to do, you know, pot something here and to take our dynamical model and try and, you know, trying to do the thing that we've been trying to do for years. And so if you have a dynamical system, what kind of feature detector threshold function model, what functional model does that dynamical system give you? There's not an obvious mapping between the two. And I sketched out earlier that at least the linear cut you could think about as being the linearization of those nonlinear dynamical equations. There's no theory that tells you what the threshold function is. And so how you derive that threshold function on this abstract space of stimulus convolved with linear filters, it's an analytical challenge to take dynamical equations and turn it into that picture. And so that's really what Mike has been working on over the past year. And so we're kind of getting there. We have, I took out the slides about that, but one can do that analysis, derive some kind of form, not a very neat closed form for what the threshold function should look like for an exponential integrating fire neuron, and then put constraints on that to say when will this threshold function show this property. And in fact, doing that provided some predictions about what we should see in the data. One was that the firing rate should be linear with the standard deviation, and that we went back to the data and that turned out to be true. And so, you know, we're sort of getting there, but I certainly can't kind of give you the crisp bottom line yet. I think
I don't disagree with anything. I like what you wrote up there, but when you said words, it sounded a little different. Mm-hmm. And it sounded as if theory was not very close to data, and modeling was very close to data.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't think that's true.
I don't think that's true. And in fact, you know, I think of myself as a theorist, and I hate not having data. There are plenty of people who are comfortable with not having data, but I like to have the slide in which my theory and the data, you know, are on the same page.
Let me propose an alternative distinction between theory and modeling. Modeling is making a mathematical or a computer description of what's going on, and theory, sort of like in physics, doesn't really try to replicate everything. It takes something that has to be true because of something you know, and use that to explain data.
I think it's really what I'm trying to get at with these points. And I actually had, at some point in my preparation of this slide, I had data kind of, and the role of data and comparisons with data in all of this. And I completely agree with you that theorists we know take very different approaches to their need to show data, right? And sometimes that data explains observations that are at a very different scale, say, from the dynamics of the network. It might explain behavior and give you a reason why an animal behaves in a certain way, and that's okay as a comparison with data. I think the theories that we have in neuroscience span, as John said, really span all levels. People work at many different levels. Some are amenable to a direct comparison with data, some less so. And I think we need to be tolerant to all of those things, because something will come out of many different scales of description.
Sadly, that's true of modelers and data analyzers too.
No, it's absolutely right.
There is a tendency to say data, meaning microdata.
Yeah.
Animal behavior is also
it's data.
Data,
absolutely, sure. No, my point there was your model is about, say, neural dynamics, and your data is about animal behavior. And so to what extent you're really making a direct test of your model from that data is, you know, unclear.
No. I noticed you didn't talk that much about the processing that might go on in the geometry of, say,
yeah,
Harvard.
Absolutely. You know, there's a whole field of interest in that, which is fascinating subject. So what do dendrites add to single neuron computation? And you know, I definitely didn't handle that at all. Just worked with what's going on at the soma. Every neuron has a soma, so it's kind of a valid thing to do. But there are many people who are working on understanding how dendrites and the complicated distribution of ion channels through dendrites changes their computational properties. And it's a very active area.
Override the soma.
Absolutely, right,
and,
right, completely shunted.
And potential
right,
all
right,
around.
Right. Yeah, no, the problem is complicated at every scale.
Also, I'm wondering how to interpret, I mean, you know, most of the treatments I saw there, it was a scalar current input, and it was noise or a signal on it. But a few times you referred to coincidence detection, and that always, you know, strikes me as integrate and fire, linear, Hodgkin, Huxley, otherwise, it's a coincidence detector. And so has sort of the idea of phase encoding of information falling out of favor, or is that just something you do much later?
So the point I wanted to make with the even raising, because I know coincidence detection means different things to different people, the point I wanted to make was to really map my parsing of the statistics of an input into mean and variance onto some things that people in the field have heard about and are, you know, the idea of coincidence detection has kind of been around for a long time. That really just means that you're going to have a stimulus that's either has a high variance or is very intermittent. And so can we take that idea of coincidence detection and just do something which is analytically tractable, which is think about how it should impact the statistics of your effective input, and then let's do the theory on the statistics of the input directly. So I, you know, coincidence detection is in my terms just a surrogate for being sensitive to fluctuation. So it's not that other forms or other interesting things about inputs have gone out of the literature. It's just what we're sort of working on processing is how statistics of input affect coding properties. So I think David talked about phase coding, for example. So one can rewrite that in this framework as being, you could imagine there's some linear filter that picks out some particular point in a cycle, and now you make it scale invariant, and you normalize out that scale, and so you'll always fire at the same point in a cycle, independent of the amplitude, if you have this kind of gain control. Well, I hope we will keep discussing many of these issues over the next few. I was hoping that there are a lot of people that we would have liked to be here, and I kind of hope that some of their work, you know, Larry Abbott would have been fun to have, Nancy weren't able to make it, so I wanted to show a little bit of the flavor of the things that those people are doing. Good. All right.